Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we're going to be featuring Jeff Currier, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing for Masir in India. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Jeff Currier about fly fishing for Masir in India. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their clean angling pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. So join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And if you're already a member, go ahead and send them a donation. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Jeff, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet, just go to our homepage, and in Jeff's section there, it says, click here to register for our drawing. Just click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Jeff's book, Currier's Quick and Easy Guide to Warm Water Fly Fishing. You can find out more about Jeff's book, artwork, writings, and adventures at www.jeffcurrier.com. So here's how you can win that book of Jeff's. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something Jeff and I have talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using the text box on our homepage. That's the same text box that you can ask questions in during the show. So listen closely and then use your best typing skills at the end of the show. Hopefully you win the book. Our guest tonight is Jeff Currier. Jeff does it all as a teacher, author, artist, guide, industry operative, and international traveler, just to name a few. With over 30 years of experience in fly fishing, Jeff manages all fishing operations at the Jack Dennis Fly Shop in Jackson, Wyoming. He has guided in the waters around Yellowstone, led fly fishers to exotic destinations around the globe, and he has taken over 160 kinds of fish on a fly rod in fresh water and salt in over 30 countries. In the winter months, he can be found traveling throughout the U.S., demonstrating and lecturing about virtually all aspects of fly fishing. When he's not traveling, Jeff is writing or painting. His watercolors of fish are in high demand, and his articles and photography have appeared in magazines, books, catalogs, and brochures. He's appeared on television on Fishing the West, In Search of Fly Water, Real Adventures in Fly Fish TV, and he's authored Currier's Quick and Easy Guide to Saltwater Fly Fishing and Currier's Quick and Easy Guide to Warmwater Fly Fishing. As a member of Team USA, Jeff led the Americans to their first ever top 10 finish at the 2003 World Fly Fishing Championships in Spain. And notably, he was the bronze medalist in that competition, the first time a North American has ever medaled in the World Fly Fishing Competition. This is Jeff's third time on our show. The first interview we did with Jeff was on European nymphing techniques. The second was on Nile perch, and if you'd like to listen to either of those shows, you can find them in our archive. Well, Jeff, thanks for joining us on Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and welcome back.
Thank you, Roger. It's good to be back.
Yeah, and when you say good to be back, I suppose you mean back in the USA too, huh, from this big adventure.
Yeah, anytime you get to your own home and safe after a trip to India, it's a good thing. Although I sure love going over there. It's a magnificent place.
Yeah, the adventure of it all is always so exciting and provides memories for your lifetime, I'm sure.
It is. It's definitely it's fun to travel, and something strange always happens or something crazy that makes for a great story that you have with you the rest of your life. And once in a while, you even catch a nice fish or two, which is kind of what it's all about.
I know that's what all your trips are about.
Yeah,
good.
But they don't always end up that way.
No? Okay. All right. Well, you're an excellent fly fisher, I know. So, boy, if you don't get them, nobody's going to get them, I don't think. Well, anyway, let's talk about this fish, the masir. It's, I don't think a lot of people know about it or that it even exists. So can you give us a little background on the fish?
Yeah, it is probably the last fish even your most adventurous anglers learn about if they're Westerners here in the U.S. or Canada. Number one, because it is very far away. They're only found in, like, Pakistan, India, Nepal, and then they vary their way over towards Burma and maybe even into parts of Thailand and in that area, but they're not that common even when you're there. They're a very difficult fish to find. Unfortunately, a lot of those countries have had terrible pollution, and populations of masir have gone away quite a bit, although India is making a real good attempt at bringing them back, and I think they're doing a good job from what I saw this last trip. But it's essentially a large member of the carp family that, rather than living in slow water like lakes and ponds, it thrives in fast-moving water of the lower Himalayas. And therefore, if you hook one of these guys, a big one, in fast water, you got your hands full. So it's really an incredible game fish. And it looks a lot, I mean, the scales look like a carp, but if you look at a picture of it, which there are pictures probably on your website that I sent to you, and if not there, and also on my website, but it looks like about five different species of fish. It looks a little bit like a tarpon, a little bit like a snook. Some people say it looks like a catfish. But if you look at the tail on the thing, it is a great big forked tail, and it just shows you right away how powerful this fish is.
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of, a tarpon first off when I looked at it. And we do have a picture of Jeff with his 27-pound and possibly a world record masir on his speakers page. So if you click through on more about Jeff Currier, you'll see at the top of the page there Jeff with his guide and that 27-pounder. So, yeah, that's a beautiful fish, too. I mean, the coloring on it is just incredible.
Yeah, the true name of the ones we were fishing for this time is the Himalayan Golden Masir. And when the sun hits them right, they are as gold as imaginable. Absolutely spectacular-looking fish. I know a lot of people thinking a carp. Why would you want to go catch a carp in India? Well, he's not really like other carp, and he's a spectacular-looking fish. I mean, brown trout, brook trout, a lot of the fish that we fish for every day are beautiful, and this fish here is incredibly beautiful in its own way. And they get big. You know, I said that you get them in fast water, but this is a fish that can obtain sizes of about 60 to 75 pounds. However, that's rare in this day and age. The 27-pounder that I got is a pretty good one for now.
Yeah, I'd say. Now, did that actually... Could you qualify that for the record? Did you submit it, or?
It's going to be submitted as a catch and release fly rod record. The all tackle record is much larger than 27 pounds. It probably is more like 75 or 80 pounds. But on fly, very few masir have ever been submitted. I know that my host Misty Dillon, the biggest he had ever taken before I got over there was 15 pounds, and on this trip, I got two 15-pounders and then the 27-pounder.
Yeah, nice. Nice-looking fish. The other thing I noticed about when I was editing those photos and putting them up was the clarity of the water there underneath you, looking incredibly clear.
Yeah, some of it was. We actually, when I got there, kind of a funny story. I travel around the world. I talked to Misty via the email just before I left Jackson, and he said, oh, it's going to be great. And we were planning on doing a 10-day float trip on a river called the Saryu River, which is pretty much the border between Nepal and India. It starts up near the border of Tibet and rolls into the edge of Nepal, and a couple of tributaries come out of western Nepal into this river, and it's supposed to be a magnificent Mahsir River. But my nickname is Monsoon Courier, and when I got off the plane in Delhi, exhausted, I could see in Misty's eyes as he reached out to shake my hand that something was wrong. And he said the Saryu River had come up 7 feet, and we were not going to be able to do that river. And, of course, you know, I just traveled halfway around the world. I was just dumbfounded. And he said, don't worry, Jeff. I have a backup plan, and it's going to be great. So trust me on this. And sure enough, he was right. It was a very good plan. The river we went to was called the Ram Ganga. Neat name on that. And it's about, a 7 or 8 hour drive northeast of Delhi. And it's probably, as far as mileage go, only 300 miles away, but the roads in India are very slow traveling. And anyhow, we got up to that river the first day after we got there, and the river was spectacularly clear, like you see in the photo with the 27-pounder. But we had some bad rain the very first day, and actually we had 3 days in a row of bad storms. It is the beginning of monsoon season, and it blew out the river. And at first I was mortified, but Misty said, hey, these fish will take flies even in the mud. They can hear the flies splat. They can see in the mud. And sure enough, he was right, because the second day we got into some good fish, including the first of the 15-pounders.
We got a question in here from Captain Sid in Mississippi, Columbus, Mississippi. And he says, and this, of course, is always the question you get, I know, Jeff, but why go halfway around the world when there are plenty of undiscovered species in this hemisphere? I don't know about undiscovered, but unless, of course, you wanted to get to your favorite fishing hole on an elephant. But seriously, is it really a trip to catch one of these fish?
Well, it is. And I mean, for me, a lot of these undiscovered fish that he's talking about, I've been fortunate enough to go fish for, whether it's South America or Central America, and I've caught them. So I just keep reaching a little further away to find something new. The Mahsir is something I had always wanted to catch. In fact, we haven't mentioned it, but this was not my first trip to India. I was over in India about 5 years ago trying to find Mahsir, and also enjoying the travel of India. There's a lot of things to see there. And the bottom line is I didn't do too well with the fly rod, so it became kind of the ultimate challenge, you might say, with a fly rod. I had to get back, and I had to get this fish. And I don't know. I'd have to say, yes, Captain, it's definitely worth the trip over there for this magnificent fish.
Well, part of it is just being in a different country, which is always exciting for any of us, no matter where we are coming from in the world, and just meeting the different people and just experiencing the different kinds of water. I think in your article or the story you sent me, you said it's almost like a Western trout stream in ways, but warm.
That's right. And I do love to travel. I mean, most people know that that's a big thing with me, traveling, fishing. But I also like travel for the culture. I mean, I love going to totally different places and just admiring the way the people live. And, you know, India is probably the most extraordinary culture difference in the entire world of all the places I've been. I mean, you get off the plane there and you feel like you're in a different planet. If you haven't done much traveling before and India is the first place you go, you're going to be in a state of shock. And not in a bad way, it's just, it's different. I mean, people dress differently, it's the place looks different, there's many different languages, and it's so fascinating, it's just incredible. I think it's the most incredible country that I've ever been to.
And a country of many contrasts, I suppose, too.
Oh, magnificent, from the different peoples and cultures and villages and languages. It's just unbelievable. And the fact that we have this wonderful fish that lives there, I can tell you right now, I will probably go back to India many more times during my life.
Let's talk about India for a little bit here. Frank Bazile, sorry, Frank, if I mess your name up there, but he said, did you have any problems arranging a trip to India, and is recreational fishing popular there? So maybe you want to talk a little bit about your first trip as well when you answer these questions too, Jim.
Well, my first trip, like I say, was 5 years ago, and it was mainly to catch a Mahsir on the fly, but also to see parts of India, and it was very difficult to get information for this trip. My best source is always to get the Lonely Planet guides. I love those. They tell me where I can stay. They give me a ballpark figure of how much it's going to cost for food and lodging everywhere I go in India or Nepal on that trip. And as far as the internet, I couldn't find much on fishing. There was this gentleman, Misty Dillon, who now I know very well, that had a website, and it wasn't anything fancy, and I shot him a couple emails and never heard from him. And he had some pictures of himself holding some trout and some pretty nice mahseer. So I was really disappointed that I didn't hear from this guy because he was really the only game out there. The bottom line is, Granny is my wife, we had to wing it. So we got off the plane in Kathmandu and did little stuff in Nepal and fished a little bit, but we pretty much rode the trains and the buses and trucked across the entire country of India in the course of 2.5 months. And it was very difficult because it's just not an easy place to travel in. Fascinating, but you do get a few stomach aches, and let's just say it's quite the adventure. And we didn't do that well. We finally stumbled on at the end of our trip down in southern India, a river called the Calvary River, and we booked a trip into there and fished for mahseer on the Calvary River, and it was a fabulous place full of mahseer, but they were a different type of mahseer than what I just fished for. These were the silver mahseer, and they have a few others there too. They have the Deacon mahseer, and they have their own golden mahseer down there, but they didn't take the flies well. I caught some small ones. The guides didn't speak hardly any English. They had their own little language down there, and they had never seen a fly rod before. And sometimes you break out a fly rod in a foreign country where they haven't seen it before, and they are just mortified. And that's the way that lower trip to India was. They just did not want to see that fly rod. They knew that it wasn't the most effective way to fish, and they didn't want me to do it. Of course, I did it anyway.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's no choice in your book, right? Or very
yeah.
little.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So did you not know about on the first trip, did you not know exactly where you were going when you left here? Or did you...
No. We really had no idea. We just knew that we were going to start in northern India and work our way, based on some of the sites we wanted to see, like the Taj Mahal, and we wanted to see Mumbai, and we wanted to see Delhi, and, go to Varanasi, the holy city, and it was all very fascinating. We went to Rajasthan, and every time we saw a body of water, I would fish it. And unfortunately, like I say, we were mostly unsuccessful. The funny thing about it, the way this, we'll jump into the next trip here, the way this next trip happened was, remember I was emailing this guy, Misty Dillon. Well, I'm standing at the Sacramento show 2 years ago, the ISE, and up comes this gentleman. He was an Indian, and he's walking towards me, and I knew right away that this was Misty Dillon. For some reason, I just had that feeling. He put his hand out, and he said, "Misty Dillon, nice to meet you, Jeff." And I'm like, "Nice to meet you, Misty. How come you didn't answer my emails?" That was the first thing I wanted to know. And he said, "Well, believe it or not, I got him about 6 months later," which can easily happen in emailing in India. Things are a lot better than they used to be. But the first time I was over there, it was hard to find a decent computer just to email my family while on that trip. And so anyway, he got my email 6 months later, and he knew that I was gone and just didn't follow through on it. But in a sense, he did, because here he was in California. He shook my hand, and he said, "You were going to catch a mahseer on fly with me, and the sooner we get to do it together, the better." And I said, "I'll take your word for it." And sure enough, we stayed in touch the last 2 years, and I guess it was about a year ago now, we put this trip together that I just got back from in the early part of June. And I'm glad I met him, because what a trip.
Yeah, well, now, is he one of the only outfitters or guides over there? Or,
I think he is the only outfitter for fishing over there. And his company is called the Himalayan Outback. And I do have a link to his site on my website, so you can check it out. And his company specialized originally in doing trekking trips in northern India, going to the Himalayas and stuff. And, really a magnificent part of the Himalayas, that northern India. And because Misty himself is a very avid angler, he has been wanting to put together a mahseer fly fishing guide business. And finally, he's getting it off the ground. He's been working on it pretty hard for the last 2 years. And obviously, by me going over there, I can hopefully help him with this business a little bit, get some clients for him. We did a TV show for Real Outdoors while we're on this show, and that will probably air in January. So hopefully lots of people will get to see it and see how wonderful the trip was. And, you know, essentially Misty will have some clients over there from the U.S.
Oh, good, good. And maybe many other parts of the world. You know, we have a lot of people that listen from South America and even South Africa, which isn't so far away, or Europe, a lot closer than we are. So, yeah, that's great. That's great. I'm glad you have that link on your site. Let's take a break here for just a second, and then when we come back, we'll talk more about that first trip. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's www.keeney.com, K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call them at 1-800-400-0359. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jeff Curry about fly fishing for Masir in India. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Jeff, that first trip, you wrote an article in the newspaper up in Jackson. What I found was interesting was that first trip, the boat you used. Can you describe the boat you used?
Yeah, like I say, those guys, they're all about bait fishing, so we had this boat that was called a coracle. And basically what it looked like was a mushroom about 6 feet wide, completely round, that was flipped upside down and it floated. So you would hop into it and float down the river. And it was made of straw and had kind of a canvas bottom so it didn't leak too bad. And our guide would just sit in a stool with about a paddle about a foot and a half long and paddle you to and from your spots. We would pull up in the bank and he would say, get out and fish. And he would expect us to bait fish, but, you know, I'd hop out with my fly rod and go for it. And my wife, she's not as hardcore with the fly as I am or the rest of us are, so she'd play around a little bit, and then she would sling the goo out there and hang out there with the guide, and which is kind of cool because I got to see all kinds of weird stuff that she caught, including some very large silver and golden masir up to, I think she got one that was almost 40 pounds on that trip.
So she did better on the bait than on the fly, right?
Oh, yeah, she did way better than me on that trip because I was stubborn. But, you know, I did wander into one of the most incredible fish I've ever met, though. There's a fish that is really in the family of masir called a carnetic carp. And when I first caught a few of them, I caught them on nymphs and I caught them on streamers. I thought that I was catching baby silver masir, and I was quite excited about it. And it was a real good fighting fish. He'd scream off into the fast-moving water and get you pretty close to the edge of your backing, and I was catching them up to about 6 pounds, basically like fishing for, you know, real big trout somewhere. And finally I caught one with my guide in sight, and he said, no, it's not a masir, it's a carnetic carp. And turns out that fish gets up to about 25 pounds. I didn't see any that big. But I started playing around with some other flies. I started doing some waking stuff with mice and with Chernobyl ants, and it turns out that fish is a fanatic of the Chernobyl ant, and I had some of the best dry fly fishing while Granny was slinging goo for about 10 days down there in the Calvary River that I've ever had in my life. I mean, carnetic carp almost everywhere you would expect a trout to live, there was a carp.
Well, now, that was a question Steve in Atlanta had, as well as what were other game fish that you found that you could fish for in India, both in freshwater and saltwater?
Well, there's a lot of other freshwater fish, too. In that southern India, I also ran into a fish called the olive carp, which I only caught one of on the fly, but he was a neat, neat-looking fish. Then the other thing that we caught a lot of was a fish called the snakeheads, and we hear a little bit about them here in this country because they've invaded parts of Maryland and other parts of the East Coast and done some damage to some of the local fisheries there because it is a fierce predator. I'm sure someone probably had one in a fish tank and let it out. And thus we have lots of snakeheads now. But it's a great fish because you throw a mouse pattern out there, a Dahlberg diver, and pop it about 3 times. If there's one around, he's on it so fast you can't believe it. And the name kind of describes what he looks like. A snakehead looks a lot like a great big old snake with fins on it. and it doesn't sound like a lot of fun to hold, but they are pretty cool, and the fight and the take is worth worth $1 million.
Does it look more like an eel?
Definitely looks like an eel and has some pretty good teeth in there, so you don't reach too far back to get your fly out without a pair of pliers. Definitely a fierce predator.
So
on this trip up in the northern part was some different species. Yeah, we had some a fish called an Indian trout, and it's not a trout at all, but it does look a little bit like one, but it doesn't have an adipose fin, and he does have beautiful blue spots kind of on him. I have pictures of one on my website, but almost like par marks on a small trout, only there are more of them than the par marks on a small trout, and a big mouth on him. He's got a kind of a trout-shaped head, but he's got a really big mouth on him. And we caught those guys up to about 14 or 15 inches on this trip on dry flies and on streamers.
Now, the water that you were normally in, though, is even for brown trout, is probably too warm yet, right?
Yeah, where we were was definitely too warm for trout. But next time I go over to India, Misty and I are going to try to head further north in India and go up to a little higher into the Himalayas and fish for trout. In Kashmir, they have superb brown trout and rainbow trout fishing. The brown trout may have been native there. They were probably brought there by the English, though. They may have at one time been native, though. It's possible. And the rainbows were obviously introduced from this country who knows when. But they're there, and I do have a friend that actually was up there fishing for him not too long ago and had excellent trout fishing. So it's got the whole package over there.
Yeah, except lacking in guide services, it seems like, or at least experienced guide services as far as fishing.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I know there's in northern India and, of course, the Himalayas, there's all kinds of guides, but whether they know anything about the fish is probably another story. Now, what did you learn from that first trip that you took back the second trip? I mean, did you bring different equipment? Did you bring a different strategy?
Well, I brought the same equipment just because of the size of the fish. I mean, this is a fish that it's possible I could hook a 50-pounder on a fly. So I last time I used my 8, my 9, and my 10 weight most of the time. This trip I packed the same rods. But I did change my tactics a little bit. You know, on that first trip, I was throwing great big streamers, tarpon-sized type streamers, casting and stripping. This time, luckily I had some advice from Misty, who has caught Musier before, but I also had some of my own ideas, and I knew I was going to let the fly swing a little more, kind of do more like Atlantic salmon or steelhead-style fishing, where you cast across and just let the fly swing. Because when you look at these fish, they're definitely ambush predators. I mean, they can pick up speed and catch anything they want, but I think they lay on the bottom, lay undercover, and wait for stuff to come to them, and then they lunge on it. So I think I was moving my fly too fast the first time I was over there. The other thing is, essentially, these are carp. They're omnivores. So a lot of times they're just eating junk along the bottom. And this trip I got to watch a lot of smaller musier, and they were acting like suckers down there. So I think your fly goes over a lot of fish that aren't interested at all. And by doing it a little slower, kind of dead drifting it, they are a little more likely to come up and grab it because it's not going too fast for them.
Both Frank DeZiel and Steve in Atlanta asked the same question about dietary habits. Sounds similar to the carp that we're more familiar with in North America, right? Or are they actually feed on different things?
They are omnivorous for sure, and they are like the carp here. But I think, you know, if you strip a willy bugger in front of a carp here, there's about a 1 in 20 chance that he's going to take it. Usually they ignore it. Once in a while they do. I think that the musier are a little more adventurous than our common carp in that, you know, probably once in every 10 times they're going to come out and pummel it. But they definitely do eat plants and stuff that are on the bottom. I saw them last trip. I saw some seeds on the bottom, and they were down there picking at the seeds, you know, something that had fallen out of the tree. And, of course, then I couldn't get them to touch anything, not even a nymph. I think I saw smaller ones zipping around the rocks looking for damselfly nymphs and dragonfly nymphs. We had tremendous caddis hatches on this river, the Ram Ganga, especially when it rained. And I'll guarantee that those musier are out there eating the nymphs. And I even did a little nymphing and picked up some baby musier with regularity on the nymphs. Best of all, though, was dry fly fishing. It's great catching those big guys on the streamers, but when we first got there, you can only imagine the jet lag. We got off the plane in Delhi at about 10:30 at night, Delhi time, after 30 hours of flying. And Misty said, "We're going to go to our friend's house, and you guys can rest up for the night, and then we'll drive in the morning." And we said, "Well, what about driving all night right now?" And he's like, kind of looked at us like we were crazy, but really, we were so excited. We wanted to get fishing as soon as possible, so we drove all night. And I couldn't even sleep in the back of the car because I was so excited. So I really was up.
Only you, Jeff.
I couldn't even sleep in the back of the car. I thought I would. And so, of course, when we got there to the river that next morning, I was just derailed, you might say. I needed some sleep, but there was no way I was going to do it. So I set up my 5-weight rod and just fished dry flies at the suggestion of Misty. And I put on a caddis, and I caught about 6 baby moss here in the fly on the dry fly that day. And really what it did, that was the only way I was going to stay awake. And all of us did it. We had to, Chris Bailey, I told you we were doing the show for Real Outdoors. Chris is the owner and host of that TV show and a very good fly fisherman as well. And his cameraman, Rick, he's a good fly fisherman too. So that first day we kind of let the cameras sit and we just all tried to stay awake and get on the India schedule and fish dry flies. And, you know, I got one that was probably 20 inches that day, so good way to start the trip.
Well, when you say a baby mahseer, if a large baby is 20 inches, what's an average one?
I would say the average we caught on the dry flies was about 13 or 14 inches. So true babies, when you consider a fish that could get up to 30 to 60 pounds.
Yeah, interesting. So you flew into Delhi, and then you went by, van or something to get to where you were going? Is that
Misty hired a driver, so it was like a little minivan, and we tied all our luggage to the roof. Of course, it rained on and off all night, so by the time we got there, all the stuff was a little bit wet. But we knew it would be pretty warm the next day, and everything would dry back out quickly. And, we just hopped in the car and drove. We stopped at Misty's friend's house, and we actually had a little dinner there. He had a really nice meal waiting for us. We ate that, and then we headed on out. And
how many hours is it from Delhi, then, to where you went?
It was about 7 or 8 hours.
7 or 8 hours drive time. Okay.
Yeah, the driving in India is so bad. I mean, the road was under construction. You have trucks traveling all the time. They're doing like 20 or 30 miles an hour, so you're making all kinds of crazy passes on them throughout the night, and then you get in front of another, get behind another one, so it's real slow traveling. But interesting as heck, India never sleeps, so you're thinking you're going to sleep in the back seat of the car, and there's just so much stuff going on the side of the road, you just can't close your eyes. You're just checking out what people are doing.
Yeah. And once you arrived, what were your accommodations like?
Well, we had the option that first night of staying at Misty's friend's house, which, as you know, we opted not to do that. When we got to the river, the Ram Ganga, the next morning, about 8 in the morning, we immediately had to hike about 3 miles into our camp. You know, this river was a river in a gorgeous valley, a very, very remote part of India. Like I say, if you look on a map and went north east of Delhi for about 200 miles, you'd see a town called, see if I can pronounce it right, Ramnagar, and it's near a place called Corbett National Park. You can see, just if you look at a map, how remote it is. There's not many towns near there. We didn't really know what we were going to do, but so it's kind of funny. We got there, we're exhausted. Missy says, "Okay, now we're going to hike for about an hour and a half to get to camp." And we just kind of looked at each other like, "You're kidding me." But it was really cool because we had porters, so we didn't have to carry any of our gear. They just took over for us. We actually had a staff of 11 that Misty put together, local people from that part of India. They grabbed their stuff and took off, and we just grabbed our cameras and enjoyed the walk, and it was beautiful. And I've done some trekking in India and Nepal. I love it. I mean, I think it's so neat to combine fishing with trekking in a place like northern India. So, you know, we were fast. We made it to our camp in about 45 minutes, and basically the accommodation was we had great big wall tents like you might see for a hunting camp here in the U.S. with cots in them. We put our duffel bags under our bed, set up our rods, leaned them outside the tent. We had about 50 feet away a nice tent, kind of an open-air tent, that we had tables and we sat and ate dinner at every night. We had a big campfire going every night. It was awesome. And all the help stayed on the other side of camp in, you know, more like North Face-style tents. It was cool. Right there in the river, we'd get up and fish whenever we wanted.
Now, is that kind of camp they keep going all the time? Do they have enough business, or did they just set it up for your group?
they keep it up most of the summer, and I don't think they have the amount of business they want yet, but they have enough that they don't break it down. They just leave a couple guys there to mind it while between trips. And, you know, I'm sure the wages for some of these people to live out in these distant villages isn't much, but they probably stay there for a couple bucks a week, and they have food and a shelter, and they take good care of it. And it may sound very primitive to some people, but it was really, really nice. The weather, other than some bad rain that we had right when I got there, the weather is really nice. You hop out, you know, walk out in the morning in your shorts and get a cup of coffee, and it's, you know, 65 degrees, and midday it gets kind of hot, but then you go in the shade and chill out, or you go fishing or go swimming.
Leanne Ross in Bend, Oregon asked, what are the most bearable months to go? Now, you had just said summer, so I would not have expected you to say that, because I would have thought it was really hot there.
I think
what months are the best, do you think? What?
Yeah, the best months would be March and April. We went in May. Our dates were actually May 20th to June 3rd, and a lot of that was because Misty was giving us a trip, you know, so we could do the TV show and so I could see his place and, you know, help promote it in the future. And, you know, people can't afford to give away a trip at the prime time. So we had great fishing. It wasn't even the prime time, but that's probably why we weren't able to do the float trip on the Saryu River, because the monsoon did start and raise the water so that we couldn't fish it. I think if you went in March or April, you would not have to worry about that as a problem. Temperature-wise, for us, it was pretty hot. It was probably, it averaged, I'd say, 85 to 95 degrees every day. We had one day that was very, very hot. I don't know what it was because I don't carry a thermometer, but we had no wind, and it was fairly uncomfortable. But, you know, you're on water, so I always jump in the water about every hour and cool off a little bit, and that's what I did. I have a feeling in March and April that it's probably about 10 or 15 degrees cooler on average, so it's probably a great time to go. And I'm going to go next time for sure in April so that I can float this river. It just sounds so neat.
Yeah, now is that a multi-day trip on the river, that float, or is it just day trips, or how do they work that?
It's a 10-day trip, and I don't know if they can shorten it all or not, but I want to do all 10 days.
Ooh, that sounds fun, yeah. Yeah, I'm a river rat at heart, so, you know, the more days, the better as far as I'm concerned. That sounds exciting, yeah. Now,
go to Misty's website. She actually shows pictures of the float trips, and you can see, and it does look really incredibly good.
And what kind of forest is, or is there forest in the area that you were in? What does the landscape look like there?
It's jungle. It's basically
jungle.
The foothills of the Himalaya, but you can't see from where we were any of the snow-capped mountains. We're really in the foothills, probably about another 100 miles before you can start seeing the snow-capped mountains and the 20,000-footers in the distance. Jungle
makes the Rockies look like toys, huh?
Oh, they're incredible. I mean, you can't even believe it when you first see them. I know I've seen a lot of people, what their expression is when they first see the Tetons, they're kind of in awe. When you see the Himalayas, you almost can't bend your head high enough to look to the top of them. I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating. It was jungle, and not very, you know, thick, wet-type jungle like you see in parts of South America or Central America. It was actually quite dry, a lot of dry leaves on the bottom, but there were areas which they refer to as thickets, which you could not walk through, not even with a machete. I mean, it would have been a lot of work to get through it. And then these beautiful little foothills kind of, you know, up both sides of the river. It wasn't quite a canyon that we fished on, the Ramganga, but it definitely had very steep hills on both sides of the river at all times, with just beautiful trees. Not pines, but, you know, various different types of fruit trees and stuff that looked a little bit like oaks and, I mean, all kinds of cool stuff.
Good, good. Well, we need to take a break here again, but when we return, we'll answer more of your questions and talk more about fly fishing for the big muts here. The Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing, the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. The Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's W-Y-O lakeshortrout.com or call them at 1-307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jeff Currier about fly fishing for Masir in India. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box there to ask us your question. We'll receive the questions immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, we have a question here from Steve Ryack in Atlanta, and he asks, Jeff, what kind of wild animals do you have to watch out for? There are snakes, crocs, tigers, other hazards, and I'm not sure the rest of his question, but let's just go with the animals.
There's a lot of them. The first trip to India, when we got down that Kaveri River area, we saw lots of different kinds of deer, and we even had elephants come through camp one day, so that was really spectacular. Where we were on this trip, where we were very near Corbett National Park, we also had elephants again. And we didn't see many, but we saw four elephants. While we were trekking up high, we got to see them down in a valley below, and another time we saw them while we were on a four-wheel drive Jeep on a track. And they're wild Asian elephants, really gorgeous creatures.
Before you talk about one of the animals you saw, and finish up what you're saying, but I want you to, you took a day off of filming, you said, and you took a day and you just went fishing. And I want you to tell us the story of that day, how it started out, and also, you know, in the course of that, let us know what animals you saw on that trip.
Yeah, it was probably the most incredible day of fly fishing in my entire life. We had been filming for about, 6-7 days, and we had pretty much got what we wanted. I had landed 2 15-pound fish on film, and we had got a number of small fish. I suggested that, hey, how about if I go fishing by myself that day, and Chris Bailey and the camera crew, they go by themselves, and, you know, because that way Chris and I wouldn't be leapfrogging each other and competing for the best water, and he'd have a good chance of getting a big fish on film for himself. It so happened that we were going to be fishing what they called beat number 4 in the Ram Gangai. It was a beat that Misty had only heard about. He had never got permission to fish this beat in his entire life. And we knew he was seeking it out for about 3 days. And when he came into camp the night before and said, we're going to beat 4, it's going to be incredible, we all kind of let out a cheer. And that's when I decided, I'm like, you know, I would really like to have one day of fishing by myself and not filming or anything and just see what I could do. Because one thing I haven't said is the Masir are very, very spooky. And when the river was clear, we would sometimes sight cast to these Masir. And you can imagine when you get a camera crew walking up behind you and you're leapfrogging your friend, you know, for the good water, that a lot of times you're spooking fish before you get to them. So anyway, beat 4 was about 8 miles long, maybe 7 miles long. And I made the suggestion. I said, well, Chris, why don't you guys fish either top to bottom or vice versa, and I'll do the opposite. We'll have lunch together. You know, perhaps you guys will get dropped up in the truck at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'll stay in the truck, go to the bottom of the beat, and by 9 o'clock I'll be fishing up. We'll have lunch together, and then you guys go down the water I fished early in the morning, and I'll go to the water you fished in the evening, and we'll meet at whatever time Misty says. And that time just happened to be 3 o'clock in the afternoon because we were this beat actually bordered the national park called Corbett's National Park, and we had to be out of there by 4:30. So anyway, we did drop off Chris and the camera crew at the top of the beat, and they were going to walk the 7 miles down, and they did get dropped off at about 7:38 in the morning. I stayed in the four-wheel drive Jeep, and we took about an hour to get down to the bottom seven of the beat, 7 miles away, and I started walking. And when I say I was alone, I actually had my guide, Alam, who's didn't speak any English, but we were a good team. I mean, we understood each other very well. He knew how I liked to fish. And we had a security guy. He worked for the park, Corbett National Park. But he didn't speak a lick of English either. And he's probably just some nice villager that lives out there and keeps a watchful eye to make sure people aren't poaching animals, because there are a lot of deer and leopards and even an occasional tiger. Anyhow, this just happened to be the day that I got my 27-pounder. I literally walked through the first hole, saw a couple fish, spooked them, didn't catch them, got to the second pull and saw that 27-pounder. And I didn't know it was a 27-pounder. I just knew it was a big fish. I knew it was every bit as big as the 15-pounder I saw, had caught. And lo and behold, I threw a a woolly bugger out there, which, by the way, that was my best fly, is brown and olive woolly buggers. Not nearly as big as you would think for such a big fish. I was fishing like eights and sixes. But I dropped the fly on this fish a little bit above him. It started to swing. The fish kind of backed up. And, again, it just looked like a blob. I knew it was a mahseer, but I didn't know how big it was. And then it just took off forward and grabbed my fly, and I hooked up. And it was a very big fish. It was a 27-pounder. It took about 15 minutes to land. We took great photos of it. By the time the whole scenario was done, 45 minutes went by. All of a sudden, it was lunchtime, and here comes Chris Bailey and the camera crew down a few minutes later, and they're like, "Curry, you've only gone 2 miles today. You need to you need to turn it around and come back with us. You're never going to make it up to the end at three o'clock in the afternoon." I was having so much fun fishing alone, you know, by myself with my guide watching and the security guy, that I didn't want to go back with those guys. And I said, "You know what, guys? I can make the 5 miles in 3 hours, because what I'll do is I will just walk full throttle for an hour, and I'll cover 4 to 5 miles, and then I'll fish that last hour and a half, that mile." And they said, "Well, if you promise to do that, then that'll work just fine." And Misty was there. Misty was a little concerned about it, but he said, "Yeah, Jeff, if you do that, you'll be fine." Well,
now, where you're walking here, when you're saying you're walking up and fishing, can you kind of describe what it's like around the stream there? Because, you know, a lot of us don't have any clue. You know, we think of walking up a mountain stream in Wyoming or Montana, but what can you give us, paint us a picture there, Jeff?
Well, this river is not particularly huge. It's if you've ever seen the Snake River here in Jackson, Wyoming, it's just a little bigger than that, which would be, you know, maybe, you know, 100 feet across at the most. Very long, kind of shallow riffles, sometimes a rapid or so would go maybe 100 yards of that, and then it would dump into a very deep pool, and then for another couple hundred feet it would level out, you know, a great big slow-moving tail out. And I always found the fish, like, right up at the head of the pool, into the rapids a little bit, and right where the rapids dumped in. Anyhow, this river, the way it turned, it wasn't sharp turns and lots of sharp turns. It was really just these great big huge turns. So, like, if I decided to walk the actual river, then I'd probably walk maybe 10 miles back to the point where we were going to fish or meet up and be done fishing. But if I went a straight line, it would be less than half that. So that's what I decided to do, because the elephants do spend a lot of time in the river. There are these beautiful elephant trails, which were, for me, like a highway. And I looked at Alam and I said, "You know, is it okay if we follow the elephant trail during this hour march to get close to where we're going to get picked up?" And he kind of, with his hand, said, "Yeah, let's go for it." So I took off. And Alam and our little security guy, they were about, you know, 5'3", 5'2", just little tiny guys. And, you know, I'm almost 6 feet. I'm not a big guy. But when I'm going fast, I can cover some ground. And I was. And after about 15 minutes of walking, my right-hand side at the time was thick jungle going up one of those hills. And on my left-hand side was, you know, real thick stuff. And the river was probably a quarter mile away. And all of a sudden, I just got this horrible feeling, gut feeling, like I shouldn't be going through the jungle at this very high speed by myself, because now Alam and our security guy were about, maybe 30 seconds behind me. And I felt like something was watching me, and I felt like it was something bad. And my instincts were that it was a snake. And the reason I had that instinct was that the boys earlier, Chris Bailey and camera crew, they found a dead python that was 14 feet long and had been killed by elephants. There are some big snakes in India. And normally you don't see them. There's like a snake anywhere. You probably don't have anything to worry about. But for some reason, I had a feeling that something bad was about to happen to me. And I just stayed there, and I was petrified, and I was waiting for something to jump out at me, but luckily it didn't. And along came Alam and the other guy, and they were just babbling away in Hindu behind me, and I looked at him, and I kind of gave him that look like, "Is it okay that I keep boogieing through the jungle here?" And they said, "Yeah," you know, with their hands, they just kind of said, yeah, "get going," you know. So I said, "Okay, I'm just being a wimp," and I took off again. I came to where I had to make my first crossing of the river. You know, I cut off one great big U of it. On the right side of the river there, it was just absolutely spectacular-looking pool. I'm proud of myself that I actually continued my hike like I was supposed to and didn't stop and fish that. I crossed
the
river.
That's where the 37-pounder was, Jeff.
Very possibly. I figured that I definitely should have fished it, but I knew Misty was pretty firm when he said, you better be there at 3 o'clock. So I took off again, and when I got to the other side of the river, Ollum and the other guy were starting to get pretty far back from me again. And it didn't take long. I got away from the river, and I got in a pretty spooky spot, and I got that feeling again, and I came to a complete stop, and this time I thought it was going to be an elephant. I mean, it seemed logical. I was on an elephant trail, and I have found elephants to be incredibly cunning in Africa. They can hide very well, and they could bust out and trample you in a second or do something horrible to you. At least that's what I was thinking at the time. And I froze up again, and my heart was beating like crazy, and I was listening. One thing, that the ground in the jungle in this part of India was all those dead leaves, so you could hear about anything. And I sat there perfectly still listening, and there was nothing. I mean, I expected something to jump out at me, and it just didn't happen. And sure enough, 45 seconds later, here comes Ollum, here comes the other guy, and they're just starting to pop out of the thickets behind me. And I look at them, and I kind of motion like it's still okay. And again, they wave their hands, yeah, get going, you're losing fishing time. So I said, this time I am not going to stop. I am just going to hoof it as hard as I can, and I'm going to be fishing next time I see them. And I went solid for about another 10 or 15 minutes. I crossed the river again, and I started making what I considered to be my last shortcut. And I got halfway into it, and that feeling happened again. And this time was a little bit spookier place. On my right-hand side, the river was probably maybe 300 yards away, and I was in what maybe was 20 years ago where the river actually went. So it was dug out kind of deep. I was almost in like a trench. And all the old river rocks that were there were actually covered with grass and all kinds of stuff, you know, growing up about waist high. On my left-hand side was the hill, one of the foothills there, kind of meandering up a little bit, and it was the thickest vegetation you could ever imagine in your life. Just beautiful green, thick vegetation, and it turned into trees. And the first thing that went through my mind this time was, this is the ideal place to run into a leopard. And I said, I do not want to run into a leopard. And again, I froze up. And right about that time, these deer called barking deer, they started going off all up and down the hillside. And barking deer sound like poodles when they're going crazy. And they were going crazy. And I immediately assumed that it was because of my presence. And I started to follow my eyes up the hill to try and spot these deer, probably no chance because it's such thick stuff. And right in front of me, 40 feet away, about 6 feet above the trail, there was this beautiful green canopy of bushes. The leaves were so vibrant green, I'll never forget them. And back behind that green, about a foot behind it, was an eye looking at me. Probably the scariest moment of my entire life. Just this great big eye, and I couldn't tell what it belonged to at first. And my heart just fell to the ground, and I started to make this eye out, and I realized it was indeed a cat eye. And I finally veered to the right, and I saw the other eye, and it was much too far apart to be a leopard, and it was a tiger. It was a tiger hidden in the thickest stuff you can imagine, right above the trail. And as I started to unfold this tiger, he was in full pounce position, like, I didn't know what to do. Like, I thought maybe this was time. This was going to be the end of career.
Jeff, you there?
Yeah, I am. I was reliving the moment there. Yeah.
You can't leave everybody hanging here.
Yeah, no, it's funny.
I was going to say, everybody's like, where, what happened?
Yeah, it's funny. It's scared as I've ever been in my life, and my vocal cords were frozen. Every limb in my body was frozen. I mean, you can't imagine the feeling. Like, I wanted to scream tiger as loud as I could and start running and hopefully get away and think that Ollum and his partner would hear me and get there in a second and save my life. But there was nothing in the tank, and I just stared at this tiger, which still was very, very difficult to see. I mean, it's amazing. An animal that's 7 feet long and orange with black stripes is just blending in so well. I mean, I could just see bits and pieces of him, but I could see the position he was in. And his eyes were right on me, and to this day, I don't know for sure if he really knew that I saw him, and whether he was just waiting for me to make another couple steps, I don't know. But We stared at each other for about 15, then 20, maybe 30 seconds, and then I saw his eye, that one eye that was in very good view, kind of shifted over my left shoulder, and then back to me, then over my left shoulder, back to me, and I knew for sure that Alam and the other guy were getting closer. And, boy, I was thanking God, too. All of a sudden, I got my voice back, and sure enough, those guys were there, and I just said, "Tiger, tiger, tiger!" And Alam, his eyes got the size of saucers, I mean, and he flew to my side. Like, he just could not believe it, and you could tell that he was a little bit scared, too, maybe very scared. And he got to my side just in time for that tiger to kind of roll his eyes, lift his head up above the thickets, and kind of turn away and just disappear back into the wilderness, like we had spoiled his lunch. Absolutely the most amazing experience that has ever happened to me in my life. Amazing because I saw a tiger, and amazing because I'm here to tell you about it. When I say amazing to see a tiger, out of our staff of 11 and Misty Dillon, only one of all these people had ever seen a tiger in their entire life, and that just happened to be Alam, who had seen one other time. Misty
Wow.
had never even seen a tiger. So really incredible. And, you know, I want to add this. There's a chance that tiger was by no means going to eat me. I mean, it sure looked like he was going to, but when you think about it, that tiger has probably never seen a Western, never seen a white man before, probably never seen anybody carrying a fly rod before, and he may have just been, he wanted to get a close look at me, so he was right close to the trail. I would have actually walked within 5 feet of him, and he might have just been, you know, had his defense up just in case. You know, maybe I would have walked right on by him. And maybe, when you think about it, the feelings I had several other times, maybe I did walk by him two other times 5 feet away. I mean, I'll never know what that feeling was before I finally saw the tiger.
Yeah, they have...
Really incredible.
You know, they talk about us having that reptilian part of our brain, you know, the oldest part of our brain stem that is the instinctual part of our brain, where we don't really think from, but it senses things. You know, I bet you that was kicking in really, really good
for you that day.
It was
a weird day because when I woke up, I knew I was going to catch a big fish, too. So I knew I better trust my instincts and I thought I was going to get eaten.
Well, that's really incredible because, well, we all know any part of the world that you're in, seeing a big cat is really hard to, you know. I mean, I've never seen a mountain lion in the Rockies at all in my whole life, you know. We were down in Belize in the Jaguar Preserve, and of course, you go to the Jaguar Preserve, but you never see a jaguar, you know, same reason. So you were lucky in a number of ways, weren't you?
I very much was, and boy, I think it's pretty cool that I saw a tiger, and I wouldn't have given up that experience for nothing.
Yeah, you're one of the few that gets to see one outside the zoo, that's for sure. And caught that big fish that day. Let's talk, when we come back here in just a few seconds, let's talk more about the actual fishing part of this and give us your secrets on fishing the muskie. So when we return, we'll be answering more of your questions and talking more with Jeff about fishing in India. Paramarquette River Lodge, a full-service Orvis-endorsed lodge, fly shop and guide service located on the banks of the historic Paramarquette River in Baldwin, Michigan, providing year-round lodging for the business or pleasure traveler, as well as a full-service fly shop and guided trips for steelhead, salmon, or large resident brown trout. For more information, visit Paramarquette River Lodge at www.pmlodge.com. That's pmlodge.com, or call 231-745-3972. That's 231-745-3972. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jeff Currier about fly fishing for muskie in India. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Go to that Q&A text box and type in your question. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll answer as many of them as we can tonight on the show. Well, okay. Now, we've got a few questions about... you mentioned the woolly bugger, but Kevin in Wilson, Wyoming asks to describe the flies and equipment. Now, you kind of described the rods you were taking over there. What about fly lines, leader setups, and flies? Can you kind of talk about your rigs?
Yeah, you bet. Just real quickly on the rod, I mentioned that 8, 9, and 10 weight is the ideal rods for fishing for these fish because you have the chance of hooking a great big one, but always bring a 5 weight along so you have the opportunity to do that nice dry fly fishing that we got to do on occasion. That was great fun. Fly line wise, you know, my 5 weight had a floating line, of course, for the dry fly, but the rest of my fly rods, I had a floating line, but also various different sink rates. My 8 weight, I had a floating line and an intermediate sink. On my 9 weight, I had a floating line, and then I had about a 250 grain Streamer Express type sinking line. And then on my 10 weight, I had a very, very fast sinking line. So some of those deep pools, I could get down 15 feet in a hurry with my flies. This particular river that we were on, because it wasn't a big river and because it got so crystal clear, thank goodness I had my 8 weight, because I caught a couple fish in those muddy days with my 10 weight, but I started to feel that as the river cleared, my line was spooking fish because it was just crashing down a little too hard. And my 8 weight with that intermediate line was quite delicate in comparison to the 10 weight with that fast sinker. And that definitely allowed me to catch more fish, including that big 27-pounder. Leader-wise, I used long leaders. I went over there with some real saltwater leaders, 9 foot for 16 pound. And what I ended up doing when the water got clear was I actually added about 3 feet of the 13.2 pound saltwater Rio tippet, which gave me a 12 foot leader for 13 pound. And that seemed to be just about perfect for those fish on this river. So I would say, no matter where you go mahseer fishing, not knowing exactly what the river will be like, definitely bring those 9 foot 16 pound leaders and a good assortment of tippet, say, 20 pound to 8 pound, because you never know how you're going to have to adjust your leaders for the river and the situations depending on rain and the size of the fish and how spooky they are. Fly-wise, I wouldn't probably ever throw anything at a mahseer again as long as I live except woolly buggers and sculpin patterns. And literally sizes 8 on the small end, but no bigger than size 4. I really think that first trip over there I was throwing too big of flies, and I really think the first couple days on this trip I was throwing too big of flies. And I may have been stubborn and stuck with that most of the time. It wasn't for Misty. Misty pretty much saved the day. He said, this is what we're going to use. This is what works. And he turned me on to the smaller woolly buggers. And it made a huge difference. It's amazing. You can catch, fish up to 30 pounds on a size 8 woolly bugger, but you can do it.
Now, Misty, it sounds like it's a fly fisherman himself. You said he was an angler, but I didn't know if he was a fly fisher.
He is a very good fly fisherman. I don't know exactly how long he's been fly fishing, but obviously more than 5 years because he had that fly fishing website that I looked at years ago. He's very into the spey fishing now, which makes a great deal of sense on some of the larger rivers that he was describing to me. It sounds like that Saryu River is a very big river, and with the jungle right up behind you, the spey rod can get you out there 100 and 110 feet without making a back cast. So that's something I'm going to have to look into next time I head over there and join him. I don't do a lot of spey fishing, but I've had a few casting experiences, and I can get it done, so I'll bring one next time I go.
Now, I take it you probably have to bring just about everything with you as far as gear, flies, line, that there's not too much available over there. Is that the case?
Yeah, you would want to bring everything. Misty does have a little bit of stuff, but it really, he doesn't have a whole lot. I would say you'd be crazy to go that far without bringing all your own stuff. I'm so crazy about it. I'm always worried about losing luggage that I pack 2 bags, and, I have almost double of everything in there in case one bag doesn't make it. But also, you got to realize when you're fishing for great big fish like this in fast-moving water, you might break a rod or two. So
right.
At least have 2 10 weights and 2 8 weights, so if you do have that disaster where you break a rod, you can still continue on. Like I say, it's just such a long way to go, you better have your stuff.
Now, there's a question here from Larry Tullis up in Utah. A lot of you probably, Larry wrote a book on the Green River, I believe. He asks, about techniques and so forth, but he also asks, would a pontoon boat have been a good thing to have along up there? Is it something that you could have used on this river?
When the river was muddy, it might have been nice for transportation. There's definitely some places where we knew that fish didn't hold, and we had to trek around them. This place had a lot of pretty rugged rocks and stuff. So, but at the end of 10 days of trekking up and down this river, we were pretty tired. But when that river cleared up, you would not want to be in a boat because those fish are so sensitive. when you look at the pictures on your website of the Mahseer, you see a tremendous lateral line, big scales and a really strong lateral line. So they pick up on any vibration. And I think, you know, an oar hitting a rock or, you know, just the sound of a boat coming down the rapids, you might spook fish for three holes below. Now, the bigger river, the Saryu River, that we're going to go back and float someday, that's a different story because it's a big river. However, I believe that we will do all our fishing from foot. We'll just be using the boats to move ourselves down the river day by day. So, again, okay. I don't think they would help.
Yeah, so you wouldn't be doing any drift fishing like we do in the West here. And what on the multi-day river trip, what kind of boats do they use?
They're rafts. I've seen pictures of them, so I'm not 100% sure, but they look just like a raft that fishing guides would use around here.
Okay.
You know, pretty primitive seat, rower in the middle, and a bunch of gear piled up in the back.
So pretty typical Western Rocky Mountain River trip that we'd imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Let's see here. We got Scott in California. He talks about asking about dry fly and sight fishing opportunities. Sounds like you caught your big one sight fishing. Is that the way you're catching most of them with sight fishing, or are you doing a lot of, you know, just blind casting out there?
I would say that when the river is clear, I was 99% sight fishing. Because these fish are so spooky, you don't want to accidentally drop a fly on one's tail and send them running or walk up on one too quickly. So what I did is, particularly when I fished by myself and Alan would, you know, of course, be in the distance in the background just watching me fish, but I would literally stay back about 60 or 70 feet from the banks of the river, sometimes go up in the jungle a little bit above and kind of crawl through the brush or crawl on the rocks back and look for fish, and then I would plan my attack on them. After I did that, and I told you that, you know, you have pretty good riffles, and then maybe even, in a sense, you know, almost pretty good rapids at times. They would dump into these pools, and then it would be 200 feet of this, you know, gentle tail out. I would walk up that tail out like that, like I said, back away, looking for fish. I would do the whole run. If I saw two or three fish, then I would assess the situation as which one would be the best one to go for first, and I would take a crack at those fish. And when I was done, whether I caught them or not, then I would grab that 10-weight rod, and I would just dredge the bottom blind from the top of the pool. I would start in the rapid, and I'd work down through that, and then right where the pool dumped in there, I would let that line drag my fly 10 feet down and strip through there. And I didn't catch very many fish that way. I caught most of them sight fishing.
The big 15- and 27-pounder that you caught, how deep of water was that you caught those in?
27-pounder was probably in, and it was crystal clear, so it could even been deeper. But I'm going to say that he was in 4 to 6 feet of water because I couldn't make him out well. The sun was out, and that just magnificent gold color that they have was just glowing down there. And, you know, it almost looked like a rock, but I've never seen a rock that color, so I was pretty positive it was a Mahseer. And sure enough, I could see it moving a little bit side to side, so I knew it was investigating stuff as it drifted by him. I caught one of the 15-pounders in a real neat situation. I actually was crawling up to one of those pools on a different day. I actually got ahead of Chris, and I saw a black Mahseer. It's species-wise still a golden Mahseer, but they get this black color, and they get in, you know, melanistic phase. And it was a giant. It looked to me like it could have been 30 to 40 pounds. And my heart was beating like crazy, and I got up there, and I slung my fly out there, and the black one kind of, he must have heard the line crash or something because he kind of slid into the deep part of the pool and I couldn't see him. And then I got a fish on. And I thought, well, gosh dang, he did eat it. And sure enough, it wasn't him. It was another big fish in the pool, and that was, you know, one of the 15-pounders I caught. But the first 15-pounder, the river was chocolate mud, and I was cast into some pretty deep water blind, and the fish must have been near the surface because the second the fly hit the water, it was just a massive explosion. It was really fun. Got the whole thing on camera.
When the water's cloudy like that, do you think the fish get less cautious and come closer to the surface to feed?
Absolutely. Definitely less cautious. I don't know if, you know, in the Mahseer's case, they necessarily go near the surface because there's so much food rolling down along the bottom, too. But when you're walking up the river, you can be talking. You can be walking in the water a little bit. I think that they, you know, because the water's high, it's probably hard for them to hear because there's rocks and stuff rolling downstream and wood. But also that mud, you know, even though they can find their food in the mud, that they can't see as good as they normally do. And I use flies different. When it's muddy like that, I use stuff that's going to push some water. So I was using, you know, really big woolly buggers, size 4s with huge hackles on them. And I was slapping them down in the water literally as hard as I could. So if there was a fish laying by a rock, you'd hear that splat and maybe come up and investigate it. And I do think that's what that first 15-pounder did, because he was first trip he was on. It was awesome.
Now, you mentioned mice patterns on your first trip out there. Did you try mice on this trip at all?
I didn't, and I do think that skittering a Moorish mouse would do very well. I don't know why I didn't try it. I think just because I knew the woolly buggers worked, I knew we had limited time, I knew we had to get fish on film, I stuck to what I knew worked. But I think, you know, as I go back over the years, I'm going to get a little more adventurous and try to find some even funner ways to catch them. So I'm going to take one of those waking mice or even a Dahlberg diver next time. I'm going to cast it across the river, and when I see a fish, I'm just going to have that thing kind of wake right over the top of him, see if he comes up and nails it. I think they will, and I think it's going to be incredible.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. You know, we did an interview not too long ago with Renee Lamaris about Kamchatka, and the big rainbows over there taking mice, you know, and they just love them there, I guess. So that's always curious to me. I mean, it just seems like from a fish's standpoint, that would be an excellent meal.
I think we got some homework for Misty to do.
Yeah. Have him sort that out before the next trip, right? So you did it sounds like you did a lot of, in your stalking and so forth, you did a lot of crawling and so forth. You really snuck up on these fish, it sounds like, huh? I mean, that's spooky.
I treated them like they were 8-inch European brown trout, which I've found to be some of the spookiest fish on the planet. I mean, I found them to be incredibly spooky. I watched when Chris and I were going up the stream together, and when we had the camera crew following us, I watched fish dart to deep pools left and right, whether it be just someone tripping on a rock behind you or, you know, myself, maybe the flash of my rod because I got too close to the river because I was in a hurry to get up to the next pool. They flat out saw you. And again, you know, fish, they detect trouble with their lateral line and good eyesight, and this fish has the best of both. When you see the pictures of these fish, you'll be fascinated how what a neat looking eye it has and how that lateral line just stands out. I mean, they know what's going on.
Would you say, Jeff, and I mean, you fished for, like we said, what, over 160 species of fish in your lifetime. Do you think the average fly fisher doesn't respect that sensitivity in fish in general, and that we scare more away than we know about?
There's no question about it. I noticed it just in my fishing today and yesterday. I was up in the park yesterday, and I was fishing on the gibbon and checked out the fire hole, and I just, you know, I kind of chill out and kick back and watch, and people just meander down the banks of streams like it's a holiday. I mean, they have no respect for the intelligence and wariness of a trout. People catch the easy ones, which is probably only 10% of the amount of fish that are out there. Why not be a little more cautious? And I swear there's only about 10% of the fly fishermen out there that are cautious. Why not be a little more cautious and try to catch that other 90%? Because at the end of the day, instead of catching 5 fish, you might have caught 25 fish. The Messier, Nile Perch, Golden Dorado, everything, all these fish. They're not stupid. They're not here in this day and age because they were stupid.
Especially these, which I figure the Matsir is kind of like a tarpon, probably an ancient fish lineage, you know what I mean? Going back to probably prehistoric times. Well, I think the carp in general doesn't it? Isn't it?
Yeah, they do look like they've been around. And they are very intelligent. I know a lot of people that fish for carp here in the U.S., and they know. And throughout the world, I know everybody's listening from all over, but we've all seen how wary and how smart carp can be. I mean, one false move and forget it. Probably forget it with that carp for 2 or 3 days. I should add something here. You know, you may be going to ask a question, but we should talk a little bit about Maasir and populations of Maasir.
Misty, yeah, go for it.
Misty's kind of a conservationist, you might say, for Maasir. He's taken it upon himself to put this fish on the map, not so much only for fishing, you know, and getting people from all over the world to come fish for him, but also because he loves this fish, and it's such a magnificent fish, he doesn't want to see it go away. And there was a time probably 10 or 15 years ago where there weren't many good populations of mahseer left in India because of pollution and people netting them and, you know, eating them, of course. And he and some of his friends have actually worked on this mahseer project deal. And let's just say this. Since they've been working on it, it is now illegal to kill a mahseer anywhere in the whole country of India. And it's starting to show. Populations are coming back. Sure, there's people out there poaching, just like they poach tigers and leopards. But it does help a lot. And also, he's doing a great deal to clean up rivers. This Ram Ganga River and some of the people that were in the staff for our camp have devoted their lives to cleaning this river up and protecting the mahseer. And evidently, 10 years ago, you could hardly find a mahseer in this river. Now, every single good-looking pool has five of them in it. So this might be even better fishing in years to come, thanks to
Misty. Yeah, sounds like it. Well, at least they're approaching it from the right perspective and the right attitude, and we're seeing more and more of that in third-world countries, you know, even down in South, you know, Central America and so forth. Preservation of our natural resources is—they know that that's one of the primary revenue sources they can have down the road too. You know, so it's a good thing. It's a good thing. I do have one more question, but before I throw that one out there, because we're running out of time here, I did want to give you, Jeff, a little time here to talk about what you're up to in your business. I know you've got your art and your books going. Tell us a little bit about what you've been up to, and be sure to give us your website address, too.
You bet. Well, I'm still a full-time employee at the Jack Dennis Fly Shop managing the fishing operations, and I love that because I'm out there in the public. And any of you out there, if you're in Jacksonville, Wyoming, make sure you come by the shop and say hi to me. We'll talk fishing, whether it's fish from where you come from or our Snake River cutthroats, or we'll talk about mahseer. I just love visiting with people, and hopefully I never have to give that up. But I am very busy with my personal work, too. I've been doing a little bit of writing. I've been doing a lot of artwork and a lot of speaking engagements. The artwork is what I like the best because I can sit at home and do a painting for someone. I can watch a Cubs game or just chill out and do it at any time, in the middle of the night or first thing in the morning, and actually make money out of my house. I just finished a very big project. I know some of you are aware that I work with Sims now, and I just did a T-shirt line for 2008. And recently finished the 2009, so next year we'll have a whole bunch of new fish with Sims. And that's been my funnest project of the year, having my artwork on T-shirts. The speaking engagement stuff, I've been speaking at a lot of clubs and doing a lot of sports shows. I really enjoy that, too. So if anybody wants me to come to their club and talk about mahseer, my mahseer trip, I'd be glad to do that. But I also, on my website, have over 15 different programs that I can do for your club or at your show. I love doing it, so feel free to call me or send me an email on it.
And also, you're usually are you at all the ISC shows during the year? Or I know you're always at the Denver one.
Yeah, I'm always at the Denver, and I will be again this year. I will be at Sacramento, I will be at Denver, and I will be at Phoenix. It's possible I'll be at another show. You can always find out where I'll be by going to my website and going to my appearance schedule. I'm just kind of putting my winter plans together now. I will be at a lot of different clubs between the shows this winter, and pretty much every night this entire 2009 winter, I will be somewhere out there, and hopefully if you can't catch me at the shop in Jackson, you'll be able to catch me at one of these events.
Great, great. Well, one final question. Pat Oglesby, a great contributor himself to the fly fishing world over in Grand Junction, Colorado, asks, you always have a few expeditions in the planning stage. What's next?
The next one, on September 13, I'm leaving for Mongolia.
And, Mongolia, Taiman?
Yep, it's going to be Taiman and Lanark, and, you know, they'd probably have a few other fish there. I know they might have some grayling and some pike as well. And you know me, I like all of them, so I'll be fishing equally for everything that swims there. But it's going to be quite an expedition because it's not going to be the normal Mongolia trip where we're going to float the Yag River or something. We're going to float a river that, according to my host, Peter Mullett, who I believe is from down there in Colorado, is a river that has never been floated by anglers before. Just some kayakers in the past did this river. So for 3 weeks, I don't even know how far we're going to go, we're going to float this river, and we are going to get remote, and we know for a fact that this river is jam-packed with big taiman. So it should be epic. I'm pretty excited about it because it's really difficult for me to get away anywhere in the summertime because of how busy we are at work. But So I've been putting it on the back burner for a number of years, but when Peter told me about this trip, I was like, I'm not letting this one get away. I am going.
Well, so, sounds like another show here for us, Jeff.
I think so. I hope so.
Well, good, good. Well, unfortunately, we've got to wrap things up now, but stick around here, folks, for the next few minutes, you too, Jeff, and we're going to give away these prizes and your book as well, so stick with us. Are you aware of the proposed Pebble Mine project in southwest Alaska? This enormous open pit would generate as much as 3 billion tons of waste in a seismic area with some of the most important trout and Pacific salmon fisheries in all of Alaska, or in the world for that matter. The well-being of Lake Iliamna and the entire Bristol Bay area waters may be at stake. If you have not already, acquaint yourself with the concerns. You can make a difference, and the ramifications reach far beyond fly fishing. Go to www.bristolbayalliance.com, bristolbayalliance.com, or Google Bristol Bay Mining. Get involved. Be proactive. Help protect our environment and the future of fly fishing. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in Jeff's section there where it says, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away the prizes we have tonight for the drawings. If you didn't register by now, it's too late. You do have to register during or prior to the show, and that puts you in a database that we draw from randomly and find our first two winners. So the first drawing we're going to do is for a three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and this is always a great gift to receive and always fun to give away. And if you want to learn more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to www.fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, and then you can learn about what the Federation's up to and all the great things that they're doing. So let me draw for that, and the winner is James Coates. James Coates. So, James, congratulations. You've got a three-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Congratulations. Now we have a gift for a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, and it's a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada, and their website, if you want to look them up, is www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. And we'll pick a winner there, and we've got David King in Tennessee. David King in Tennessee. So congratulations, David. Well, now, hope everybody's ready there on the home page, because we're going to give away a copy of Jeff's book. And Jeff, I want to make sure that they give me the right answer to this question, so I'm going to have you decide whether they do. And it's the first person that submits their answer in the text box along with their name and location. If you don't have it all there, then you won't qualify. So first person to submit will win Jeff's book. And that's Career's Quick and Easy Guide to Warm Water Fly Fishing. And, of course, this will make a great addition to anybody's library, especially with so many fly fishers showing an interest in warm water fly fishing now, so I'm sure it'll find a nice place in somebody's library. Well, okay, so the question is, this is an easy one, question is, what is Jeff's favorite fly for the masseur? Jeff's favorite fly for the masseur. Now, this should be easy. You should have almost anticipated this one. So, Jeff, I'm sitting here refreshing, looking for someone that's going to submit an answer. And let's see if we've got any takers here. Here we go. We've got an answer, Paul in Asheville, North Carolina. And he says the woolly booger. Is he right, Jeff?
He's right on there.
He's right on. Okay, well, Paul, you just won Jeff's book, and congratulations. Career's Quick and Easy Guide to Warm Water Fly Fishing. And I know there's some in North Carolina. So, Paul, if you will use that same text box and send me your email address so that I can communicate with you. Then I'll get your information through email so that we can pass it on to Jeff and he can send you out the book. So congratulations. Jeff, thanks for offering a book tonight. That's wonderful of you. And
my
thanks
pleasure.
Also for just being on the show. You're always a great guest, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it was nice to be here. I really appreciate you inviting me on again.
Well, and it's going to be tough to beat that tiger story the next time around, though, Jeff. I don't know. Could it be woolly mammoths in Siberia? Is that
I kind of hope I don't beat it. Hopefully I don't beat it ever again.
Yeah, that's one you don't want to relive at all. Yeah, Yeah, I guess. Well, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Our next broadcast will be on July 16th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show we'll interview Mike Reeser, and our topic for the show will be Roosters in the Surf. On that show, Mike Reeser will share his newly discovered fly fishing techniques in hooking and landing rooster fish in the surf. Consider this the advanced course in stalking rooster fish that you won't find anywhere else. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Keeney's Fly Shop, Platte River Fly Shop, and Pere Marquette River Lodge for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.